the May meeting, May 2008 meeting of the County Health Commission. I'd like to welcome everybody who's here. And the first order of business will be the approval of the minutes from last month. Are there any corrections or additions to those minutes? There being none, I will entertain a motion to accept the minutes.
So moved.
I second.
Moved and seconded. All those in favor?
Aye.
The minutes are approved as distributed. Next item of business is the public comment period time. This is the time when anybody who wishes to make a comment on a subject that is not on our agenda is welcome to come forward and state your name and make your comment. You will have 3 minutes.
Happy Bike Month, and if you get a chance around on the other side of this block in a basement on Oso Street, there is a very fun bike art show, and I hope that all of you have safe places to use bicycles, feet, and other health-promoting means of transportation. The less cheerful topic I have is apparently about to drop on our heads like a ton of bricks is the governor's May revise for the state budget. Our Board of Supervisors, whom you advise, does have a legislative platform and does communicate with a very, very competent lobbyist in Sacramento, Mr. Don Peterson. And so, given that it is very likely that the governor's proposal will have very significant health consequences in all sorts of ways. It may be that you would want to have some kind of a study session on that budget and recommend some positions for our county to take relative to that budget. I suspect it's going to be a fairly excruciating process and may not be resolved at the normal constitutionally mandated time. In fact, it's almost certainly not to be, and it may be that the comments they get from local governments and through the legislators that hear from their local government will determine the final outcome more than anything else, because it's going to probably be one of these things where it balances back and forth on the backs of one or two legislators to make a two-thirds majority in each house. So it could be that you're in a position to make a big difference if you actually manage to study the issues and speak up on them. So I urge you to get acquainted with the May revise and its consequences, and look to alternative priorities and alternative ways of handling the difficulty. Personally, I believe that we could fill, in fact, this isn't just personal opinion, it's personal priority. It's a statement of fact that we could fill almost half of the budget gap simply by putting the vehicle license fee back at its historic 2% level. In so doing, we would no longer be subsidizing the single-occupant vehicle the way we are now, since it used to be that the full cost of the vehicle license fee pretty well took care of road maintenance needs. At least on the local level. Now those are being taken care of from other sources, including our young people, thanks to deficit financing of Prop 1B. They're going to be paying those debts back for the next 30 years, or they will be denied health care for the next 30 years because the paying of those debts will be a senior obligation on every state budget for the next 30 years before we can start spending it on current needs. Anyway, there are lots of ramifications of this, but the situation is very serious, and I think the effects locally will be significant enough that they are worth the investment of your time and effort. Thank you.
Thank you for your comments, Mr. Greening. Is there anyone else who would like to make a comment? Very well, then. We will now move forward to our next item, which is a report from Biz Steinberg, the executive director from EOC. On the Ombudsman Program, as you know, that is one of the proposed service level reductions.
Good evening, members of the Health Commission.
Liz Steinberg. I do work at EOC. We have been honored and privileged, actually, to operate the Ombudsperson program. I think it's almost 4 years now, with the closing of General Hospital and the transition of the old family care clinics over to the community health centers of the Central Coast. So I wanted to just give you a little background and then kind of just a challenge for all of us, I think, as this program is slated to end with this fiscal year. The Ombudsman program has greatly benefited persons between the ages of 22 and 64, before Medicare and after children and youth programs, a lot of times, those who weren't able to access coverage. This program assisted anybody and everybody across the whole spectrum with any type of health care issue, such as chronic and terminal medical conditions, special services for our homeless population, mental health issues, behavior issues, and services connected with those, assistive technology, people with disabilities, and this is a huge one, navigating the healthcare system. I have trouble with my own sometimes, and then negotiating paying those healthcare bills, setting up payment plans, etc. It has also helped vulnerable consumers connect to other kinds of services that they need that come up in the conversation or with the providers. And a big helper there has been Hotline and 211. The Ombudsperson program has been a very effective program for healthcare consumers. That was the intent when it was set up a few years ago. And it resulted in improved working relationships between staff in all the different healthcare systems. And I've circled that when I give Lynn my comments here. That is going to be what we have to all count on in the future. With the program not being formally funded, we are going as a community to have to continue to work to gather all the nonprofits, public agencies, and the healthcare community to make sure we still have quality health care for everyone in the county. It's also provided an important opportunity to offer community feedback and practical suggestions for continuous quality improvement of local systems, including community health centers. Just a few outcomes from I just grabbed off the computer from calendar year 07. There's been a lot of health education. That's one of the components. So our ombudsperson, Mary, has represented this program at least 20 community meetings every month. Now, when you can be in those, meetings every month of providers, you just keep the current information out there for folks. Provided healthcare education to 1,969 target population consumers at 98 community presentations. And with the help of Marcia Bollinger, our system is really accurate on this. To keep track of what services have been provided. Distributed over 13,000 flyers at different presentations, health fairs, and community venues. 783 individuals were assisted with one or more health care issues. So that's key in access. I know when I sat on a group with, Lynn, a few of you, to come up with the Health Commission, I know that access is a huge issue for you. And 1,092 linkages or referrals were made for needed services. So the work hasn't stopped over all this time. Mary, who has been our ombudsperson the last two and a half years, she has been very diligent to work with SenCal as of, when March 1st came. Actually, the Santa Barbara Health Authority, as they were known in Santa Barbara, matched the grant that the county gave to us for this year and last year to really support that. And part of the work program was then to get information out in all of these groups as well about the change of Medi-Cal managed care coming to our county, which started a couple months ago, March 1st. And then I have just a number of little vignettes. I'll just pick out a couple, but I'll give your chairwoman some of the different client assistance, which can be seen in any of the narrative reports that go up to public health every every single month. We've had, and I know about this one, a 28-year-old homeless woman with very high blood pressure, who was 7 months pregnant, was linked directly to CHC's OBGYN medical services. She had not been in, you know, sometimes when our homeless folks come to us, they haven't been in, she hadn't been in ongoing medical care to receive prenatal care, but at 7 months was able to be linked with the OBGYN Department of Community Health Centers. A new mom of preemies was recently diagnosed with a brain tumor, was assisted to set up with CHC specialty and medical care and early start services through Tri-County's Regional Center. She's also now going to be receiving care at Stanford Medical Center. These are just all the folks that slip through cracks, and I think that's partly what, as well as educating the community and the providers and the consumers, the Ombudsperson Program has been extremely active in connecting all of the services. I mean, what Mary and whoever, you know, this job, the connectors she knows about is just amazing to me. I can't even begin to tell you. So how that gets replaced is going to be through the connectors she's already, you know, set up with folks. It will be continuous quality assurance and improvement as far as consumers. I read in your minutes that CHC is going to have a North County line, I guess maybe as a backup kind of phone number, and I didn't have a chance to call them to ask what that actually is. But people need feedback. So at this point, I know that the County Public Health Department budget that you work with is just a real tight situation. And so I guess on this one, what I would have to say we will be committed to is all of our family advocates in all of our programs for EOC, our case managers for the homeless services program, the teen parent folks, everybody, the senior health screening program, the adult day program. We are one agency that's committed to trying to keep this kind of connector going, not in a person, but in what Mary has taught us. And I think public health and all of our partners, unless there's, you know, somebody wins a $50,000 lottery and can keep it going, we're trying to prepare for all of us continuing the efforts that have been going on for 3 and 4 years. You know, this was set up as a kind of a pact with the public when the hospital and the clinics went through changes. CHC has definitely grown. We now have access through CHC from San Miguel over to Cambria down to Napomo. That's all real positive. It's just for the folks who are slipping through or didn't quite know where to go, folks who speak, you know, Spanish, we've got a lot of information out, and your commission will be updated in June when we have our new flyers ready to distribute during June on the transition. So I'm open to any questions, but I just wanted to bring you the update. I appreciate the county support and your support. In the past, I think Mary would come every couple of months to give you an update from the program directly. So I'm going to give Lynn my comments.
Okay, we can probably scan these in and get them around to everybody. Be good. Thank you so much, Biz. Don't leave, because I'm sure there's questions. Thank you very much for coming and talking to us about this, and you know, we all are so aware of what a fabulous job Mary's done, how dedicated she's been, and it will be a loss. There's no way around that. So are there questions for Ms. Steinberg, Commissioner Hetherington?
Thanks, Biz. I know this is going to be hard for all of us, because I know that many of the commissioners have watched, you know, that program flourish and have been satisfied that we're not losing people, you know, between the cracks. But I think that's one of our big fears, is that that could develop with that position eliminated. And I champion you for filling those shoes and wanting to keep that up. How feasible is that?
Well, we can only keep it up in kind of what I'd call an informal way. And that, I really mean from what Mary has taught all of us, not just at EOC, but at all the different nonprofit organizations and community health centers. We also have SenCal now, who is going to have a customer representative person that will help people, you know, going through the Medi-Cal managed care situation. So what I mean is it's like my word that all of us that I know are going to try. There's no way to follow in Mary's footsteps and catch every person. But as soon as we find or hear of somebody that needs assistance, we'll try to. And, you know, we serve 40,000 people a year, so we're certainly going to be on the front line. I think the Area Agency on Aging, a lot of the, you know, umbrella groups, the Adult Services Policy Network is another key group that looks at issues of adults. The Children's Services Network is here on behalf of children and youth. So healthcare, having just come from one of those policy meetings last week, I know quality healthcare for all of our children is a priority. And so we would definitely, through those entities, be able to keep the word out that we need to connect people. And when we don't have an answer, I know I'll be calling probably Jeff when I can't figure something out, because the county has been, you know, public health has been extremely helpful to us in this partnership. So it's like our word, Pam, and I guess I'd have to say, I would say it on the nonprofits when we go to our CBO hearings in June. You know, many of them, I know, would, that's when I'll see them all next, or at a United Way agency meeting where I will be briefing them and alerting them that we are going to need to keep trying to funnel through systems for the very vulnerable folks we all serve. I mean, that's really my only response.
Well, that's what I wanted to hear. I wanted to hear that, you know, all of these agencies that Mary's been working with are aware that that program is probably going to go away, and that, you know, they're willing to do their part. And I know Children Protective Services and the Adult Policy Council, they're good at that. So, you know, it lessens the anxiety as far as worrying about that.
You know, in the summer when people, you know how summer is, we'll have to maybe get out a set of the handouts again, the flyers, in the fall when school starts back up again. Because this kind of ends in June, and then we've got a couple of months of, you know. CHC, you know, I do sit on their board, so I will certainly be verbal on cases with them that we need help with.
And I guess that's the other edge of the sword, too, is that they're looking at budget cuts from the county as well. So, you know, we're kind of slicing both ends of the spectrum. And if we can't have those people watching because of money, then, you know, what's going to happen? I recall, and I'm sure you do, that before the Ombuds program came into being, that people would come to the Health Commission and complain that things weren't getting done. And that's fine, because it gives us the pulse. But
right.
I don't
but
think
you know,
that.
If we get back to that, then I guess the other thing we could always do, I mean, Lillian's an extraordinary grant writer and thinker, and as she's researching for different areas of service, you know, if something comes along that looks like, because we've been trying to find dollars since all these potential cuts have been coming, we have not secured a source. But it doesn't, I guess that would be the other thing. If another source comes up at the federal, I don't think it'll come up at the state level, but you never know what we might come across to pass something together. But I can't promise you that. I can promise my word in trying to work with all the nonprofits to help their clientele, and that we have a little, you know, powwow if there's some clientele that aren't getting service with SenCal or CHC, or they've just fallen through a crack. We will do our utmost.
We're here to help too.
Yes, and I guess a good measure will be if they start marching back over to chat with you all.
Commissioner Warren.
Yes, I had a question. When you first started, you talked about this program being for 22 years and up. What about the 18 to 22 year olds?
I meant that if somebody is not connected to a stable program, you know, it's easier for me to say that about a 64-year-old who maybe lost their job or retired and didn't have benefits, and they don't get benefits until they're 65. Now, we have always been helping 0 to 90 in the ombudsman program. Okay? Now, anybody on Medi-Cal is going to be served through the CenTel organization, and they're shifting out, so that's on medical care. Kids up to 18 are Medi-Cal healthy families, or if their families are a little above the healthy families, they are eligible for healthy kids. And that's a one-stop shop through the Department of Social Services application process, and then healthy kids works with the family. I know Jim Roberts is more the expert on our foster youth and helping them. They have caseworkers that help them get Medi-Cal. So that will be a CenTel.
I just know that there's often a lack of services from once the kids age out of foster care, or they're considered an adult at 18, and from 18 to 22, there aren't always a lot of services for them and a lot of resources.
So we will, again, I don't mean to leave any group out, and we have them as our teen parents, too, so I'm there with you on that group, too.
Mr. Shimosa?
Hi, Biz. I want to echo Pam's gratitude for the work that you do. I know you guys are great. And the ombudsman program hopefully will be filled by all of the agencies that are working together. And particularly, you mentioned the Adult Services Policy Council, which I liaison with. And they are in the process of putting together the community-based continuum of care for adults. And I'm hoping that that's geared toward the providers, and I'm hoping that that will give some assistance in terms of expediting getting folks where they need to go in a timely manner. And I'll keep the commission as well as
that's
the viewing
great,
public updated on that.
That's where I have Lillian. She goes to that.
Yeah, she's great. Yeah, Lillian's pretty amazing.
So it takes everyone with parts of things to make the whole again. The WHOLE.
Are there any other questions from commissioners? Not only have we been extremely lucky to have Mary, but this county is extremely lucky to have you.
Oh, thank you, Lynn.
And now, is there any public comment on this subject?
Mary Greening, and I'd also like to thank Biz for the tremendous work and the tremendous scramble under the current circumstances. I would like to remind everyone that until the third week in June, the formal disappearance and unfunding of the position is a proposal, not a fait accompli. I want to make sure the people out there in the public also know this, that until the Board of Supervisors makes the decision as the Board of Supervisors, it has not actually been made. The health department has basically and painfully said, well, it looks like a place we could cut if we have to, and Biz has been working to minimize or mitigate the damage if it is. But it is not a done deal, and there is still time for you to encourage the health department to actually go at issue and advocate rather than simply go under, as most departments apparently are being encouraged to do. To make this a nice, quiet hearing that seems to go easily. I think from the standpoint of public education, it should be an ugly, painful hearing where the Board of Supervisors has to hear the consequences of every cut in every department, and certainly in the Department of Health. And I would rather not see it happen quietly. But I'm glad to know that we're preparing for the eventuality. The question I have for Biz now that she has sat down is, if you were a client and you would have called the ombudsman, number one, are you going to somehow be informed that that position is now vacant? And number two, whom do you call? I mean, what is there going to be some clear, crisp, concise instruction at all the places where care is delivered that this is whom you call, or won't there be such a person? And I guess this is something you may find out, because it's true, they may end up here. But given that a lot of people are going to try to help pick up pieces of what one person so confidently did, which piece are people going to look for?
Well, Eric, is it okay if I respond? Should I respond? Okay. The people who are calling would be calling either CenCal, CMSP, or Community Health Center to start with. You know, Medi-Cal and the CHC clientele is everybody. They also, they're also a provider of Medi-Cal managed care for almost 20,000 of our participants in this county. And then CMSP, which I can't explain as well, but obviously you all probably know a lot about the CMSP program run by the county, is another alternative.
Thank you. The advantage of the ombudsman is it's one person you can call when you have a difficulty. And from the standpoint of the public, this is going to be a disoriented change. But thank you for that information, and I'm glad it's being heard out there. As is the information that the final decision will be the third week in June. I don't yet know which day, but probably early in the week.
Thank you, Mr. Greening. Is there anybody else who would like to comment? Dr. Hansen?
Good evening. I'm Steve Hansen from the Medical Association and the Tobacco Control Coalition. I'd like to remind you all that there is one popular tax, and that's tobacco taxes. It's being not put forward as a possible solution for some of our budget ills because of political contributions to legislators that take tobacco money. That's simple. Our two minority party legislators are better than most. They've agreed not to take tobacco money, and they need to be encouraged to support taxes on tobacco, which would help programs like Biz's and many others. So keep that in mind, please. And we really do need to lobby actively at this time about it. Number two, you're going to be hearing more about tobacco control incentives throughout the community. The newest data shows that exposure to passive tobacco smoke for only 30 seconds causes constriction of the coronary arteries in susceptible individuals. This is much more than we used to think about when we passed our landmark legislation here in San Luis Obispo in 1989, for example. So we're going to be asking for more smoke-free public places, beaches, parks, other recreation areas. The county's going to be asked to enact a law to improve the oversight of sales to minors throughout the non-city areas of the county. The jail is going to be asked to become tobacco-free. They still allow the Honor Farm people to smoke there. The prison went tobacco-free 3 years ago without incident. All 170,000 in the 33 prisons throughout California, no tobacco is allowed on the ground in any prison for any inmate or staff person.
Dr. Hansen.
Thank
you for your comments. I guess maybe it wasn't clear that this public comment was just on the subject of the ombudsman.
I was late to the early, but
we are going to
bear on any of your financial issues.
That's true. Thank you for your comments. Okay, that seems to wrap up that subject, and we have Ann McDowell here, who is going to talk to us about the Valley Fever incidents and the reporting in our county. Welcome, Dr. McDowell.
Good evening. I'm happy to be here. I'm Ann McDowell. I'm the epidemiologist for the County of San Luis Obispo for the Public Health Department. And I wanted to come here this evening and talk about COXI. I understand from your last meeting you had a number of questions. So I'm going to give a brief presentation about COXI that's really designed to answer your questions about COXI more than give you an in-depth review of COXI, but I will, of course, go over some of the points so that you get where you're going. Am I starting? What did I do? very wet season, you'll see a dry season, and maybe that during that dry season, or especially the year after, you'll have an increase in the number of coxi cases because the coxi has reproduced itself in the soil. It's much more prone to being blown about. It's much more prevalent in the soil and comes out. Now, once you inhale the coxi and it gets inside of you, it forms these endospores, and it reproduces itself within your body, causing all the pathophysiology of disease, all the symptoms that you're going to see from coxi. This is sort of a history of what happened in San Joaquin Valley, where they noticed a huge spike of cases between 1991 and 1995. And it got them a little bit concerned, and now there's a lot of resources devoted to coxi in the San Joaquin Valley. We're actually very lucky about that. The morbidity and mortality from coxi, 60% of people who are infected by the fungus are asymptomatic. They show no symptoms. They don't know they have it. They carry on as they were. With 40%, you see a mild to severe disease. I think that what brought this to your attention was we had a little blurb. Dr. McMillan went over a little outbreak that we had where 50% of workers at a construction site came down with coxi. Almost all of them had between severe asthma symptoms to full-blown pneumonia. Some of them were in the hospital for several days with pneumonia. It can be fatal for people. You don't have to be immunocompromised for it to be fatal, but people who are immunocompromised are certainly more susceptible to the fatal syndrome. How you get it? You inhale it. It's not transmitted from person to person. If I have it and stand next to you and cough in your face, you're not going to get it from me. Animals can get coxi, but if your pet has coxi and it's in your home, you're still not going to get it. What you see is, as I talked about earlier, increased incidence after the dust is disturbed. So how does the dust get disturbed? Lots of different ways. You have dust storms and earthquakes. After the Northridge earthquake, they noticed a spike in coxi cases from the dust that had been disturbed during the earthquake. Construction sites, obviously, we've demonstrated that here, but they've demonstrated that in multiple sites where you have large developments going on and there's a lot of dust being kicked up. People in surrounding areas have had increased incidence of coxi around those areas. So what do we do here in San Luis Obispo County? Well, coxi is a reportable disease. That means that the California Code of Regulations requires all clinical providers who diagnose a case of coxi to report it to the public health department. The laboratories do not have to report it, which is unfortunate because it's diagnosed in a laboratory. So a physician will send out a blood test looking for an immune response by the body to coxi, and they'll get the lab results back, and then the physician reports it to us. What we have noticed over time for those diseases that are reportable by laboratories and physicians is that we have a much higher reporting rate from the laboratories than we do by clinical providers. Now, we at the health department track all the reportable diseases. We look at them all the time. We put them out in the public health bulletin on a quarterly basis. I'm working right now on the annual health status report that will also put out statistics about how many people get coxi among many other diseases. And what happens in an outbreak, I saw somebody's comment that outbreaks are considered two or more persons. That's not true for every disease. That's certainly true for a foodborne disease, where we look and see if two people who are unrelated complain about the same place getting symptoms of a foodborne disease, then we do, in fact, consider that a possible outbreak if we begin an investigation. But not every disease is like that, and coxi does not fall to that trigger. So what we do is every week we get a report of all the diseases that we have reported to the state, and I review those every Monday morning. We monthly look at the diseases for the monthly report so that we can check on a longer time period. Quarterly, of course, the health bulletin comes out, and annually the health status report comes out. So we're constantly looking at numbers to see whether or not there's an unusual trend in the numbers. And several years ago, we thought we saw a spike in salmonella, and we looked and looked and looked, but we couldn't find any common cause, we couldn't find any common source, but it was just an upward-leaning trend that caused us to take a closer look at those things. And of course, when we do circumstance, we call the California Department of Public Health, and they are usually willing to, they're usually more than willing to come in and give us a hand. And when we do get an investigation or an outbreak, certainly in the past several years, we've become much more proactive about doing what we call risk communications, communicating to the public what's going to happen, what is happening, what we're investigating, what we're looking into. We have a number of ways we do that communication. The public health bulletin does not just go to clinical providers throughout the county. It actually also goes to the media. But when we do start an investigation, one of the first things we do, we have a rapid fax server. We will send out faxes to all the hospitals, all the emergency rooms, all the clinics, and physicians that have specialties in that area, telling them of the circumstances, what we're looking for, to have a heightened suspicion, to look into cases of these types of things. We then will also do a media release often when we alert clinical providers. We learned long ago when you send out something to the emergency rooms that the media gets it anyway. So anytime we send a fax to the emergency rooms asking for heightened awareness, we just send it to the media as well, and then they can call and we can get all our information out to everybody. We put things on our health agency website and, of course, once again, the public health bulletin. This is the number of cases of COXI per 100,000 people by county. You can see that Kern County is certainly the epicenter of COXI. It is, quite frankly, the hot spot in California. I can't speak for other states, their statistics as well. You can see that San Luis Obispo also has its fair share of cases, as does Monterey. We've been seeing a slightly upward trend in COXI over the past couple of years. It's really hard to tell sometimes why that is. To be honest, what we know at the health department is that clinical provider reporting of diseases is spotty at best. We encourage providers to report. We encourage, and it often slips their mind anyway. So if they're in a period of heightened awareness, when they've been thinking about it, when they've been hearing about it, when it's in front of them, then they'll think to send us a report of a communicable disease. We always see that. So when we do a press release about a disease, we'll see even more cases come in because the providers will be thinking about it and think, oh, that's right, I'm supposed to report this. These are the number of cases for the past 5 years by the age range. I saw that one of your questions concerned what is the age breakdown for people getting COXI, and this is what it is. Now, people with compromised immune systems are obviously much more likely to get COXI and have a more severe course of disease from catching it. But you'll see that the greatest number of people that we're diagnosing is between the ages of 46 and 65. So we're not, and it's a little bit of an arbitrary line at which point clinical providers will decide when your immune system is starting to go down. Some people will say it's 40, some people will say it's 55, some people will say it's 65. You decide. I like to think it's on the higher end. But here we're seeing the majority of our cases in the 26 to 65-year-old age group. So it's not really, but one of the reasons you might be seeing this is a more active group. So you're not necessarily going to see the 65 and older as exposed to dust as people who are out there working in the dirt, playing in it, and being exposed to it through a variety of activities. So this is actually very consistent with people who are outdoors being the most diagnosed age range for this disease. Jean gave you a handout about this, which is good because the map doesn't look that great from here. This is the number of cases that you see in our county for COXI. Obviously, Paso Robles is one of the highest areas. Paso Robles, what we do know is that North County is our highest rate of incidence. We have the highest number of diagnosed cases up there with 198. Now, this is by zip code, so don't think this is all within the city limits. It's not, but the cluster of red dots is a pretty good indicator of where most of those cases are falling. And they are, in fact, falling in the city limits, but you can see that some of them are falling in the countryside as well. The next highest grouping is at CMC with 90 cases. Now, what you need to understand about CMC is they do have a hospital out at the California Men's Colony. And people who are sick, not every prison in California has a hospital. So people who are sick are sent to the California Men's Colony. So they tend to have a higher diagnosis rate at that location. first time, and then we report them. So I am not convinced that we see an especially high rate of COXI in the prisoners out at the California Men's Colony. I do see we see a higher rate of diagnosis. They're very good about reporting, but they do have the medical facilities to handle ill prisoners, and so you see them diagnose more diseases. The rest of the cases you can see now, there's a fairly low number in Santa Margarita, California Valley, but that's due to population density. I think if we had a much denser population out there, you'd probably see higher numbers. So, are there any questions? Okay.
Well, let's start at this end. Let's start Commissioner Hetherington.
Thanks, Anne, for coming in and giving us these facts. I serve on the Planning Commission in Atascadero, and I brought this up at our Planning Commission last week. And apparently nobody had any idea about the construction workers that had gotten it. And so I emailed the public health bulletin to the planning staff, and my question to you is that part of your outreach so that planning departments throughout the county are educated on looking for these types of connections to the valley fever, and using that educational tool maybe would help prevent some of these cases where, because I think that Dr. McMillan's recommendations were pretty solid about, you know, wearing masks where maybe construction workers wouldn't be wearing masks. But have you looked at that outreach into the planning departments of the county and city?
I have not. I do not control the distribution of the public health bulletin, but I see no reason why planning commissions throughout the county could not be added to the public health bulletin mailing list. This is one of the very few diseases, I think, that you will see affecting a sector like the business other than injury, because it is something that's stirred up by dust and brought about through construction activity. So I'm not certain that many of the health bulletin articles are going to interest them, but you're right, this is one that probably would be very interesting. I would like to point out, however, that those are just the recommendations in that public health bulletin are actually from the California Department of Public Health. Those are an extremely edited version. We have put the full version on the public health website that's much more thorough, and they are extracted from a letter that was sent from the Department of Public Health to the employer in question and also to the work site in question so that they could understand what they might need to do in further activities at that site. And we strongly encourage people to look at them if they want to see the full breadth of the recommendation.
I guess to come full circle on that, I was thinking that if you could take the unedited version, put it in letter format, get it to the planning department, they in turn could copy that and hand it out when people come in to do major projects where they're going to be disturbing a lot of earth. I know the project in Atascadero had to do with making some detention ponds for the Nacimiento recharge, and they were going to be in some riverbed area, or at least I think 150-year flood zone areas that had not been disturbed previously. And there's a good chance that, you know, they could kick up some of the spores there. So, you know, I really wanted them to be aware of it. It's not mandated. They're only recommendations. But I think if you could get that educational tool to the planning department, encourage them to copy for, you know, contractors coming in for building permits, you know, it's going to help everybody maybe not contract the disease and also, you know, maybe lower their workers' comp rate.
I have extreme doubts about lowering their workers' comp rate, but perhaps we can look into finding out all the planning commissions. I certainly think that planning commissions themselves are going to be the ones to be issuing recommendations to employers in the area. But we have received calls asking us at the health department, what kind of recommendations do you put out for employers? They said, we've called the Air Pollution Control District. We've called the Planning Commission. Nobody has any recommendations regarding what to do to protect yourself if you're working on-site in county. And that was one of the reasons we put the full letter up on the health agency website, just to make sure that there is something somewhere. But I will look into finding out if planning commissions are interested in receiving this.
Commissioner Tilscher.
Thank you for the presentation. I had a question about the labs not reporting. Is there anything underway to have that happen to increase the reporting?
Well, lab reporting and clinical provider reporting is all under the California Code of Regulations. So we locally have virtually no input into that. They recently expanded the section, I think it's 2505, Title 17, Section 2505 covers lab reporting. And they recently expanded it slightly, but in my mind, not enough. I've actually written letters to the California Conference of Local Health Officers asking why every disease that is lab diagnosed and reportable by a physician is not reportable by the laboratory, and received no reply. So this is an issue that's a no-brainer to me, but I am not the one that writes the California Code of Regulations, so there's not a lot I can say about that, other than I have personally pushed for it in the past, and every time I get an opportunity, I push for it again.
Mr. Shimizu?
I actually have a couple of questions. Thank you for your presentation. I was curious as to why there is such a concentration of the incidence in this area. Do the spores naturally occur in all soils, or is it something sort of indigenous to the San Joaquin, you know, Paso area?
It is. It's through the southwestern United States, so Arizona, New Mexico, parts of Nevada, and the southern parts of California are all considered endemic, parts of Mexico as well. So the fungus just lives in the soil here. There's no way to get rid of it, and it's pretty much everywhere. But they have a much higher concentration in the San Joaquin Valley than they do out here. Why? I don't think anybody's really been able to tell why certain soil is so preferential to growing this particular fungus.
And the other question that I have is, when there is kind of linked with what Pam was asking in terms of construction, is there any soil testing done prior to disturbance of especially undisturbed, previously undisturbed areas in terms of determining the level of the presence or non-presence of the fungus?
Soil testing for toxins, a tricky issue. Not a lot of people do it. As a matter of fact, I am slightly chagrined to report that we are still awaiting soil sample testing that we did on the construction site back in November, December. The soil, to the best of my knowledge, is still sitting on a desk waiting to be tested. There just are not that many places that test it. We are actually very fortunate that we have a retired professor here in the area who could do that type of testing, and his lab is so backed up that when we took the samples, he said, I'll get to them in May. If there was a demand, I'm sure more laboratories would go into the business, but right now there aren't a lot of laboratories in the business, and I'm sure you'd hear a lot of screaming if you made that issue.
And there is no prophylaxis for that,
For coxie?
Yes.
No, there is not. They are working on a vaccine. I kind of cut that out of my presentation, but I'll tell you that there is a prototype human vaccine that they're working on moving to trials at this time to see. But as you know, or may not know, vaccine development is a multi-year process. They go through many, many trials to determine its efficacy and safety. So I'm sure it'll be several more years.
What about soil prophylaxis?
None, no.
Thank you.
Commissioner O'Dell, and then Commissioner Donnelly.
On your graph here, what lines are these? What determines this?
These are zip codes.
They are zip codes.
Yes. There's other ways to do this. You can put census tracts or things like that, but the way we get reported is we don't get a census tract on a report. We get an address with a zip code, so it's much easier for us to put things in zip codes and report about that way.
Fine zip codes.
Some of them, yeah.
Yeah.
Hi, thank you very much for your report. It's really informative. I had a couple questions. One of the things that I was interested in knowing, you had mentioned that when there's an incident and then the blast reports go out and stuff like that, that doctors have a more heightened awareness of things. What I'm wondering, are there any established protocols, like in the San Joaquin Valley, where it's already endemic and they know it, they've been dealing with it for a long time, where the doctors, I think the reason why I'm asking for my question is because the delay in diagnosis can really have an effect on the outcome. And are our doctors, is there some type of a protocol? that they just automatically know, okay, we're going to test for COX-C, or is there any kind of a protocol like that that's already been established in endemic areas that we utilize without having it, having had been some sort of a outbreak already?
Clinical providers are very free to follow their own algorithm. There isn't really a mechanism in place to force them to follow an algorithm. A lot of it has to do with awareness. In the San Joaquin Valley, clinical providers are extremely aware that they live in, the California Valley fever epicenter, and they know to test when they have respiratory symptoms. We tend to do as much education as we can so that our providers are also thinking about testing when you have a pulmonary symptoms that are unexplained by anything else. But we can only do so much as far as getting people to think about it. And we cannot mandate that a physician test for certain things under certain conditions. It's really because they're the person that knows the patient, and they have a much better idea than we do sitting at the health department about what sorts of tests are appropriate for their patients.
I thought you said you had a couple of questions, Commissioner Donnelly. Go right ahead with your next question.
Okay, I'm sorry, I don't want to keep you forever. One of the other questions I had is, it had talked a lot about things for construction sites, and that's an area that we know that they're having issues, but what about just the average homeowner? Like, I live in an area in Templeton that, you know, our parcels are anywhere from 1 to 10 acre parcels, and you're out there, I mean, people are on their tractors, or you're doing grading. How deep do you have to disturb the soil, or should you be even concerned about that just as an individual in your home and kicking up dust that might be closer to the surface?
It doesn't have to be very deep at all to kick up the dust. It lives right near the surface and just under the surface. We actually had another outbreak back in 2001, I think, up at the Paso Robles Boys School, because the inhabitants there were leased to a fire crew, and they walked behind a tractor putting out embers at a fire site, which, of course, kicked up an incredible amount of dust immediately into their faces, and no surprise, a lot of them came down with COX-C. So when you talk about disturbing the soil with tractors and things like that and dust clouds, yes, you're at risk for COX-C. There's no really nice way to put it. Just about, you know, if you're up in a dirty, dusty region in this area, you're probably at risk of catching it sometime.
One more question, so these things keep popping into my mind. Is COX-C altitude sensitive? In other words, is it happier at lower elevations than the higher altitude?
I'm not sure. I think that it is, but I'm not certain about that.
I have one question. How do we treat it?
Well, it's a fungus. So there are antifungal medications that can be given to people, and it will cure you. It's not known, but it is strongly suspected that having been infected will give you a lifelong immunity. So once you've gotten it and your immune system's responded, it will probably stop you from getting it again. But mostly once it's diagnosed, you get antifungal medication.
And they are effective?
Yes, they are.
Commissioner Warren. Thank you for your presentation. I was just curious, and maybe I missed this, but where the little dots are on this map were specific areas where the COX-C was disturbed from.
Those are the residences of people who have been diagnosed with COX-C.
Okay, so they could have picked it up someplace else.
Absolutely. So
okay.
If you have somebody who's living in one area and commutes to another, they could have been exposed at work. They could have been exposed during the commute, quite frankly. They've diagnosed people who've just been driving through dusty areas, and they had no other exposure other than driving through that area has been diagnosed. So you can be exposed in a number of ways.
Okay, well, now Mr. Arnold keeps jumping up and down. Do you have a comment you'd like to make, Mr. Arnold, or a question?
Hello.
Okay, go ahead.
Sorry Dan Hicks couldn't be here tonight, because we talked about it after the meeting last time. We both had friends who were killed by this disease, so that's why I'm concerned. My first roommate at Cal Poly came from the Philippines. down on that, what groups other than the immune deficiency people that are more susceptible?
It's not believed that Filipinos are more susceptible to getting COXIE, but there's different forms of COXIE. Once you are exposed to the fungus, a lot of people will develop respiratory symptoms, but there's another form of the disease, and that's called disseminated COXIE, where the fungus spreads throughout your body. It gets into your joints, it gets into your organs, it gets just about everywhere. And Filipinos are more susceptible, along with African Americans, to the disseminated form of COXIE, and it's not known why that is.
But the they could be killed even though it didn't go to that stage, or it has to go to that stage for it to be fatal?
Well, if it's simply a pulmonary infection, you can still die from pneumonia. So if you get a severe enough case of pneumonia and they don't understand what's catching it and you don't get treatment, then yes, you can still die of the pulmonary form. Once you have disseminated COXIE, you are more susceptible to a very to a lifelong set of symptoms, problems, and possibly a fatal outcome.
My friend just thought he had a bad cold and didn't get it diagnosed and died quickly. So I would say he didn't get the, didn't have this, what did you call it again? The
disseminated.
Yeah.
Well, if all he had was just mild respiratory symptoms, then something else happened. Something else within his body failed for him to die if all he had was the mild respiratory symptoms. So he probably did have some sort of disseminated disease.
The other thing that came to my mind was he was buying grapes. They were raisin grapes. But you say our cluster here is in Paso, which we all know is a grape-growing region for wine grapes, but they're still grapes. And perhaps they're handling the soil in similar ways. So I'm wondering if you track how many of these people who got it in Paso are construction workers and how many are working in the vineyard.
I would love to. Diseases are reported on a form that's called the Confidential Morbidity Report Form. And there is, in fact, a spot on that form for the clinical provider to check the occupational group of the person that is ill. Rarely is it checked. In some instances for foodborne diseases, we 100% of the time go after the clinical provider to find out if they are a food handler, to make certain that somebody who's got a foodborne disease is not serving other people, food handlers, for instance, and we exclude them from the workplace. With COXIE, we simply do not have the resources to follow up on every single case, to go back to the clinical provider and find out what their occupation is if the clinical provider has failed to fill that part of the form in.
Anyway, does the department make an effort to warn people, Filipinos and African Americans, that they do stand a higher risk from this disease?
No, I don't think we do targeted risk communications, is what you're talking about. We don't do that. We tend to warn people generically throughout the county that they are at risk of COXIE and warn the clinical providers of the sequelae.
And as far as the people at CMC, there may be fire crews working out of there. That came to mind when you mentioned the incident with the fire crews. That might be one of the more cases there. Yeah. So thank you very much for your report. Oh, the other question I had was the 60-40 breakdown. Someone can get the spores in their body and they show no symptoms. Does that mean the fungus can actually be growing there and not harm them?
Well, what's happening is their immune system is taking care of it to a sufficient degree that they are not going to get symptoms from it. So it's much as if you were exposed to a cold virus and you either get very mild symptoms or no symptoms at all because your immune system gets in there and takes care of it for you.
So then the immune system would kill it off and be done with it.
Yes. It's been exposed. It knows it's been there. In other words, if you do a blood test on that person somewhere down the line, you'll see that they had an immunologic response to the presence of the fungus. They just did not have any symptoms of the disease.
Okay, my recommendation to the commission based on what we've heard is that we do advocate for the reporting. Go through the Board of Supervisors, of course, and try to get better reporting, as Rob alluded to earlier. And the other one would be to get the Health Department to do targeted notification to the more susceptible groups, or do that as much as we can.
question. Relative to the discussion about planning departments, planning commissions, et cetera, probably the key place to go, every project that is defined as a project under the California Environmental Quality Act, you have to go through an initial study to find out whether it gets a negative declaration or an environmental impact report. It gets a negative declaration if there are no significant impacts that are left unmitigated. Otherwise, you do an environmental impact report, which people don't like to pay for and take the time for if they can avoid them. I think it's important, then, that in this county, the Environmental Division, through Ellen Carroll, and in the cities, whichever part of the Planning and Building Department is responsible for environmental checklists, is given the suggestion to probably under hazards and hazardous materials have something on the checklist with the information from the unedited version, you know, the full version of recommended protocols, so that the only way that a project is considered not to have a Class 1 unmitigated impact is if they attach those recommendations as conditions of approval on the project. That's probably the best way to make sure that these protocols are handled. In addition to local government and its land use authority, there are some heavily ground-disturbing projects where other departments are their own lead agency, state departments such as Caltrans or the university system. I know there's a major Caltrans project going on adjacent to downtown Atascadero right now, and I've seen dust coming up from that and affecting not only the people who work in it, but whoever is walking on the streets in the vicinity. So somehow we need to communicate with state agencies such as Caltrans and suggest that they do something similar with their checklist, preferably on a statewide basis. Maybe we can be the one that sort of sparks a new way of doing things. But I think if people are given the choice of making sure the condition of approval protect the public and the people working on these sites, or having to do an EIR for every single project that disturbs the ground, we're going to get some conditions of approval that may do better at protecting the public health. And even when an EIR is done, you mitigate whatever you can, and so those conditions of approval belong on projects with EIRs as well. Thank you.
Thank you.
One more thing about construction sites, and that is you'll notice oftentimes when you see construction sites, there'll be a water truck on site spraying water to control the dust. And that is probably the number one way to control a lot of dust at these sites that they're picking up. And in fact, there was a problem at the site that generated all this interest in this outbreak. They were not able to get a sufficient quantity of water onto the area that was dusty. It was a very dusty day. It was a very dirty, dusty place, and they just simply could not get enough water onto it. So really, I encourage you to think about, when you're thinking about recommendations to protect the public health, the recommendations that are in this letter were really tailored for people that are working on construction sites, working at the spot of the dust. But what you're not talking about is the people that are a quarter mile down the road or in the wind from the plume of dirt that's going down there. And what you really need to do is dust control at the site, and you need to be really encouraging the firm to do a lot better dust control with water spraying, and that I actually think would be your number one way of protecting the public health and more of the public than just the people working on site. So.
Thank you very much for a very informative presentation. I think we all enjoyed that, and now we'll move to the next item on our agenda, which is the continuation of the discussion of the health agency budget. Started last month, and I will... Oh, I'm sorry, Commissioner Hetherington. That's okay. I would like to re-agendize this with an action item for next month, that maybe we could craft a letter to the Board of Supervisors recommending that, you know, this information be disseminated to the planning department, planning commission throughout the county. Commissioner Hetherington has requested that we put this on the agenda as an action item next month to write a letter recommending.
recommendation to the planning department. I see no problem with that, so we'll do that. Okay, now, Commissioner Shimosis.
No, I would just have to...
Commissioner Heatherington is now going to take over the discussion of the... No? No, aren't, but, oh, let's get back to this agenda item. This is your agenda item, Commissioner Shimosis. The continuing discussion of the health agency budget. I'm sorry, you misunderstood me. Okay.
I don't think that there's really any further developments in terms of further proposed cuts. So I don't know that there's any further discussion other than what we've already heard on the ombudsperson. And I don't know if there's any interest from the rest of the commissioners in discussing other budgetary cuts. If so, please go, Commissioner O'Dell, thank you.
Why don't we hear from Jeff Hamm first, before we discuss, isn't that the next item?
I've had the opportunity to hear Jeff do this presentation more so maybe than other commissioners, and it gets better and better at it every time. So please enlighten us as to further developments, Jeff.
Jeff Hamm, Health Agency Director. There really isn't any new information from the discussion that we had at your last meeting relative to the budget development process. My recollection is that you wanted to put this on your agenda and entertain ideas amongst yourselves about what you might, if you want to do anything, and if you do, what you might want to do. And I'm certainly happy to try and answer any questions that you have about the budget development process.
Are we still at 18?
We are.
We are. Now, the governor's May revise comes out in the next week or so.
Wednesday.
And then will you take another look at this at that point, or what is the process once he drops that bomb?
Yeah, unfortunately, the answer to that question is it depends. It depends on the extent of the impact of the state budget development process on counties generally, and of most particular concern to our county. You'll recall there was a classic example in last year's budget with regard to the AB 2034 program, the outreach program to mentally ill homeless individuals. The governor proposed to eliminate $54 million funding statewide for that program. Everybody thought it was such a bad idea that it wouldn't sustain itself through the budget development process. He reiterated his position in the May revise. Both houses of the state legislature restored funding, and he ultimately blue penciled it out of the budget, you know, on his own authority to do so, in the last days of the state budget development process. We do expect this budget year to be record-breaking in terms of its tardiness. We won't know really what kinds of things specifically will impact us in terms of the revenue estimates that we've included in the budget probably until the very last actions of the legislature and the governor in reaching approval of the budget. So we might still be very, very concerned about hundreds of thousands, if not $1 million worth of revenues that we've included in the health agency's budget in various programs that will be at risk. We know they'll be at risk. The governor's unlikely to make really significant changes in what he's going to propose. We'll know on Wednesday. Folks in county government all over California are anxiously awaiting the May revise. The Senate and Assembly budget subcommittees have been holding hearings all along. They'll continue to engage in that process, you know, starting on Thursday. So we're going to pay close attention. There is great risk. Like I said, we could find ourselves $500,000 to $1 million in the hole once the state budget is adopted with three quarters of the fiscal year to react. And our hope, of course, is that the county would find some way to mitigate that impact. But it's increasingly unlikely, given the county's overall financial condition, that they're going to be able to just go to contingencies or one-time money to backfill behind state budget reductions. Just a really bad time to expect the board to be able to do that.
I would like to share with the commissioners that Jeff did do a presentation at the Adult Services Policy Council, got into more of the long-term effects of these proposed cuts, and that it isn't a one-time deal, that it will be developing over the next 2 to 6 years. And in terms of addressing issues about the Board of Supervisors' involvement and knowledge of the process, Supervisor Gibson was at that meeting, as was his assistant, and the assistants of several of the Board of Supervisors do attend that meeting, so they were privy to that information, and Supervisor Gibson was very active in questioning Mr. Hamm about the budgetary process and what's involved and their concerns about the ombudsperson cuts, as well as the cuts to the community health centers. And again, it's going to be kind of evolving over the next several years. It's not going to be just a one-time deal. Do you want to add more to that?
I'm hoping that we won't be talking about this for 6 years. We're hoping maybe 2. Yeah, the only other point I'd like to stress, and it people do get tired of hearing all the bad news. The county's using a whole bunch of one-time money this year going into 08-09. Half of the $18 million is being, half of that gap is being bridged by funds that are one-time. And it's very, very unusual, and it's very unlikely that that volume of one-time funds are going to be available next year at this time. So this year was bad. Everybody is saying next year will be worse. And then we hope that we'll start to come out of it. Isn't that great?
Are there any action items or action proposals from any of the commissioners at this point in time? I didn't really see anything that, thank you, Jeff, that as a commission, other than what we've done thus far, can assist the process. But Commissioner O'Dell and Commissioner Donald.
Well, I thought we were going to discuss the ombudsman position, because carried over to this meeting to hear from EOC, and I thought we were going to discuss that.
We can discuss it. I guess I'm more or less at a loss in terms of having heard more of the presentation in detail. It's certainly going to be a big loss to the county, as well as to all of the people that use that program, if the commissioners wanted to write a letter to the Board of Supervisors supporting that position and urging them not to cut that, or however we want to proceed with that, then that's my recollection of what we talked about the last time. Commissioner Donnelly?
That's actually, I agree with Commissioner O'Dell, and I do think that, I mean, I know that I believe that I agree also with Eric Greening that we should be there, and it is in a position that I think most of us really believe that's important. We might not be able to save it, but we can try. We can send a letter to them supporting the position, and I think that they need to hear maybe a couple of those cases that Biz talked about so that they can see the important work that's being done, and then maybe have a representative from our commission go and speak on our behalf to support that position.
I agree with both of your comments, and I think that maybe further looking at the position, that maybe it wouldn't take a full-time person. Maybe the educational part could be done on a quarterly basis or a semi-annual basis, but I think having that person running interference, I mean, it's nice to think that all of the agencies would pull together, but I think having that one person was the cement that kept the safety net in place. So I would definitely be for a letter going to the board suggesting that that position, you know, maybe be revised in its description, but as much as we can save the safety net part of it, I would be happy for that. I guess this is where I take over. Oh, Commissioner Warren, I'm sorry.
Well, I just have to say at this point, I have more concern about the $500,000 cut to CHCC and all the people that are currently receiving services who probably won't be able to receive the services they need, you know, versus the few that just might not get the information or whatever it is from the EOC ombudsman. We've got people here who may actually not be getting services at all that need them.
I think I can say we don't have to confine ourselves to one motion. We're free to make any number of motions we want to make. How effective those will be is, you know, who knows. But we are the Health Commission, and we do have the opportunity to make a motion if we want to. So I think at this point, well, Commissioner O'Dell, did you want to add something?
No, I just want to make a motion.
Okay, well, I would entertain a motion. So please go right ahead.
Well, I would like to move that we've identified the ombudsman as an extremely important position that has really worked in the past, and that we advocate from this commission to the board of supervisors a letter as well as the position that we, on the mental health board that I serve on, that also it would help is individual visits to the supervisor about this position, not just a letter. So I so move.
Let me understand the motion. The motion is that we write a letter to the Board of Supervisors advocating that they retain the position of ombudsman, and that we also initiate a series of visits to the supervisors to advocate this position. I'm not sure you want all of that in the motion. If there's other motions, then I guess we could add that, the visits I meant. You could add that on to the other motions as well. I mean, you would, if you were going to do that. If we advocate anything, then we should probably follow that up with visits. So.
Well, it doesn't have to be in the motion, just that we advocate, and it's the method that we advocate is what I was trying to stress, other than a letter.
Okay. Okay. All right. Well, then we need formal language for the motion, and the motion will read that the Health Commission wishes to advise the Board of Supervisors that they support the retention of the position of the ombudsman, and that they do so by forwarding a letter to the supervisors and any other means of communicating with them that are feasible.
Yeah, it's called lobbying.
We don't use those words in motions, though, I don't think. Does that meet with your approval? If that's the motion, then we'll need a second. Does that meet with your approval, Mr. O'Dell?
I want to do a little more discussion in terms of what Commissioner Warren suggested. Do we want to do two separate motions, one for the ombuds program and one for the CHC?
Well, Commissioner O'Dell has indicated that his motion is just for the ombudsman. Now, if we decide we don't like that, we can change it. But first we need a second, and then we can have discussion.
I'll second the motion.
Okay, it's been seconded by Commissioner Pilcher. The subject is now open for, the motion is now open for discussion. Is there discussion amongst the Commissioner Grena?
When I do a budget, it's a zero-sum game. And I don't know how we can make a suggestion that the Board of Supervisors not cut here unless we give an example or a recommendation of where they can cut somewhere else. And so it's it's nice that we're saying these things, but we really need to come up with a, where's this money going to come from then? Now, is that incorrect? Don't we need to maybe make a suggestion?
Go ahead, the discussion's open.
I think, what's the next thing on the list, the priority list? I think sort of what we're saying is that we feel that this position is a higher priority than, I mean, that is essentially what we're saying, is that we'd be willing to let go of something else in, because we feel that this position is so important that it's a higher priority. I don't know, as a health commission, is that our job to decide that, or can we just let them know that we think it is a higher priority than the items that fall probably directly beneath it?
Well, we would let them know that if that's what we thought. Go ahead, it's open discussion.
I think our position as a commission is to recommend what we think should be done, and we are not the budget analyst. I mean, what you described, you would have to analyze all the other ones and say, well, and this is, and that's not our role. And I believe for us to advocate for what we believe in, that's our role.
I agree with what Commissioner O'Dell stated, but I also agree with Commissioner Kara that there does have to be somewhere where it comes from. I think my thought on that is, why does it have to come from us? Is there another budget that might have a little more leeway in it? And also that Dr. Hansen mentioned the tobacco money. Is there money out there that hasn't been, and Jeff's grinning and shaking his head. just a thought.
There's a total, I think, on Jeff's original list, 66 things that they were looking at. He stopped at 18. That was his line. I don't think it would be feasible for us to say, okay, instead of this one, cut this one. I think that should be left up to the budget department. That's my 2 cents.
No, not the last word.
No, I don't believe so. Once we take the action, you're welcome to make your comments about it. Case, first the commissioners will say everything they want to say, and then the public may make their comments before we take a vote. How's that? All right. Go ahead, commissioners. Go ahead. Here, it's open.
The ranking on this list, then, is that a relative ranking? So number one rank for sure, and as you get down to number 18, it's a little softer. In other words, if that is the case, can we vote to that we recommend moving that down the list?
I understand your question.
Okay.
And as Pam mentioned, those were the first 18 items on a long list. They were placed in relative order. The least unacceptable, higher on the list, increasing the level of unacceptability or pain. The further down you go, the worse it is, in our collective professional opinion. As I mentioned, the ranking of these items was a very interactive process that involved just about everybody in the health agency that had an opinion about it. You're absolutely right. You can either just say we just don't think this should be cut, or you can say we think that the order is wrong. We think that this is a higher priority. This is, disagree with the order they're in and say, we know how hard it's going to be for the board, we think this should be saved, and we'd recommend that you instead go down and pick up the next one, number 19. It's up to you guys, whether you want it, however you want to do it. But it is a zero-sum game. Not that I would want to do anything to discourage you from exercising your prerogative
recommended budget for the health agency includes $1 million increase in general fund support for next year over the current level of general fund support. There's $1.5 million of cuts on the list, 1 through 18, but it's $1 million more next year than it will than it is this year, which is a fairly unusual thing for health agencies to get if you look statewide. But again, just for context.
In other words, we're pretty darn lucky. Is that what you're saying?
It could be much worse.
Yeah, okay. Continue the discussion.
I just kind of wanted to bring it back to something that Commissioner Hetherington said. It's actually a relatively small amount of money, and some of the other cuts that they're making are a lot larger, and so if we can make it even more appealing to them, I think the one aspect about the position that at least I feel is most important is the safety net aspect of it. And I agree with Commissioner Hetherington that I don't think it needs to be a full-time position. And so if we would be able to even save more money by, it's really just having that one person there that does have those connections and also can gather the information and, you know, then otherwise we're even going to lose the reporting aspect of it. Who are these people? And they'll just disappear into never, you know, we won't know who they are or where they're coming from. And I know that the people that are, that CenCal is going to have somebody for those people, which I think would further reduce the time requirements for the ombudsman. So I don't think it needs to be necessarily a full-time position that we're advocating for, just that base level safety net.
And I still feel that maybe I'm wrong, but I thought when this position was developed, it was developed to help transition over to using the private provider, and that it was a time-limited position to just help in that transitional phase. And that's what I thought I heard Biz saying, and that Mary had been out working with Area on Aging and the homeless shelters and all these various programs that pick up these folks and work with them in case management to help them know now what the system is. I don't know that do we still need a safety net if they're directly working with these new systems, and they're not new now. They're up, they're running, and they have been.
Good question. Now, the question was called, which means we have to cut off the discussion and move to a vote. However, because we have this unusual component of the public, we'll get their comments now, and then we will move to a vote.
Thank you. I'm Eric Greening, and hopefully the public won't be an unusual component as we go through this process, because you need the public at the county budget hearings advocating for the health department, and so that should certainly not be discouraged, and the public needs to advocate before the action is taken. I do support this motion because I think it's a critical position, full-time, part-time, or whatever. It is critical to have a person that people know they can call, not the confusion of maybe you go here or maybe you go there. However, there is a broader context, and I think a broader motion that also needs to be made, and this addresses Commissioner Warren's issue of there are other cuts proposed that are very hurtful, even though they may not be cuts of county employees per se. And that motion would be that it is the position of the Health Commission that the Health Department be considered a part of our public safety department, given that, for example, the sheriff was given a special opportunity to make a presentation about the threat of gang activity in this county at a time when other departments did not have a similar opportunity except 3 minutes as public, because they were the public safety people. I think a motion to the effect, and something that might garner public support to the effect, that the health department is a public safety department and should be considered as such in the budget proceedings. The health department saves lives. That Thank you.
Thank you for your comments, Mr. Greening. I think you mistook what I said. In normal Robert's Rules of Order, you have the people who are on the board or whatever it is that's voting. You're a different component. So we are just changing how we would do things. So please don't misunderstand me. We appreciate the public comment.
Okay. Thank you. I'm Jesse Arnold. I'm here to comment again. I'll support David's motion. I'll support Susan in wanting to not cut CHC also, because that was to take the place of General Hospital to quite an extent, if I remember correctly. So Ed's right. If we have to be budgeting, we have to say, well, what else are you going to cut? I would look at it the other way. What Eric alluded to would say the vehicle license fee. I'm sure the commission won't want to go there, but if we don't want to cut, and we're advocates for not cutting health care, we have to say, well, we would suggest you're going to have to raise these taxes. So that's where I would go. That would be my suggestion. And we could start with the vehicle license fee. So thank you very much.
Are there any other comments from the public? Okay. The question has been called. It has been moved and seconded that we write a letter. I'm sorry, that the, would you like to reread the motion, please? Because I know you wrote it down.
That the Health Commission advise the Board of Supervisors that they support retaining the ombudsperson position by forwarding a letter to the Board of Supervisors and also advocate by other means.
So it's time to vote on the motion. I think a show of hands is probably good enough for that. So all those in favor of the motion, please say aye.
Aye.
And raise your hand. Well, we have to have a little fun here. Okay, those opposed? Abstentions? So the motion has passed with, how many of us are there here? All but one abstention and one opposition. I believe that's correct. So we will move forward with writing a letter and making some arrangements for other lobbying. Now, any other motions? Yes. Thank you.
Okay. I would like to make a motion that that we ask the board to look at other cuts rather than cutting the $500,000 from the basic care that CHC provides the community.
Motion on the floor of that the Health Commission advise the Board of Supervisors that they examine other areas to make their, and you weren't specific about the areas, so other areas to pull the funds to maintain the CHC level of funding. Is there a second for this motion?
I'll second it.
Okay, it's been moved and seconded. Discussion is open.
Open.
I have a question for Mr. Hamm. The summary sheet, it talks about, it estimates 3,000 patients will be affected by this. Have those patients visits, have they been thought through where else it's going to be handled? Are we really thinking that 3,000 patients are going to be unseen, or will they be taken up in other areas?
Again, speaking for the management at CHC, who responded to my request to describe from their perspective how they would have to react to a $500,000 reduction in the county grant amount, they said that would require that they downsize by two providers and the support staff to go with them. So essentially two positions fewer out of the total number of providers that are providing services through their clinic system. So it's an actual reduction in treatment capacity.
And is there a buffer for that? Can it be absorbed elsewhere?
Well,
are we actually
can't be in a macro sense, it cannot be absorbed elsewhere. If we're just looking at what CHC provides to the public they serve, we asked for some pretty specific information, and they went so far as to tell us which clinics they thought would be the right way to react. From a business standpoint, I'd have to say primarily, as opposed to a safety net or coverage standpoint, because they've indicated one of the two Morro Bay clinics would be the first thing to go, and the Cambria clinic would be the second thing to go. That's what they told us. As I think I've mentioned, if the board adopts an appropriation that provides for less than what the contract language would require in what will be year five of the five-year contract, which is a decision that would be made in June and not before that, but if they do reduce from approximately $5.4 million, anything less than that would require that we notify them in writing, we get together, and we see if we can't reach an agreement on revised terms. It really isn't going to be a very difficult thing, because as I've shown you, and I think as you've seen the utilization statistics in that bar graph in the past, they have grown since the first year of the contract in terms of utilization by about 14% from year to year. It's gone from 142,000 patient encounters in the first year of the contract to about 210,000 patient encounters this year. That is a much more significant rate of growth than the growth in the county's funds. Our funds have increased at about 4% a year over that period of time. So if they were in a position where they needed to close a couple clinics, as long as they weren't the clinics that were in the base year where we specifically called out, you have to have these clinics and you have to have this much capacity, they've so far exceeded that baseline that we would be able to require of them, that they could substantially reduce with, and we would have nothing, the county would have no course of action against them. Okay? Does that make sense? So, but if when we reduce the grant amount, if they'll have to come to the table, and then we'll talk about what will they propose to do. Cambria just happens to be one of the ones that they can't close down without our agreement. If they had picked a clinic that they'd opened since the county entered into the agreement, which they have been free to do and have done since 2004-05, they wouldn't need our agreement to close that clinic or to reduce. So it depends on how they propose to shrink and how that relates to the numbers in the contract.
Has the public health department considered what impact 3,000 patients unseen would impact our health care? Would it increase our ER visits? Would it raise costs in other areas?
We don't have good empirical data for our population, but those we imagine, of course, that those are the kinds of things that will happen. Depending on where the capacity is reduced, we're going to fight against them closing the Cambria Clinic. They've already begun to, essentially, they've already relocated their staff from Morro Bay 1 to Morro Bay 2, so they've already made some changes to adjust. We imagine that some number of folks are going to defer care or not seek care. Some number of folks will seek care in emergency rooms. I mean, it'll be a slight undoing of the tremendous improvements that have been made in the 4 years since we entered into the agreement. Not that a slight undoing is a good thing. But it is 3,000, and I've been using patient encounters, but it is, you know, the average patient, according to their data, is 3 visits a year, 3,000 people, 9,000 visits. So they were predicting a certain number of visits for year 5 of the agreement, and they were expecting to continue to see a fairly significant rate of growth. And so the reduction in encounters of about 9,000, based on their information, wouldn't necessarily even be fewer encounters next year than this. It will just be not as many as it would have been. Maybe.
So my question is, and I know Commissioner Warren is particularly concerned about the Cambria area, are we concerned about the Cambria area particular, and is that a way we should we focus on that? Or just do you want to just go ahead with the overall?
No, it's overall. I'm not just concerned about Cambria. They've now got services in San Miguel and Shandon and very underserved areas that have never had services before. And when you look at that's where most of our indigent people have been forced to move. That's where their rents are cheap. But the gas prices and everything else, you know, we're really pulling the rug out from the people that can least afford it. And now that we've finally gotten services to them, I think this is a pretty poor message coming from our county. And I know, having lived in Cambria and trying to access services when you've always got to drive 40 miles. And when it's a health issue, that's really difficult, and a lot of people just don't go until it's an emergency. And we're talking all these unincorporated outlying areas that are finally getting some services.
Point well taken. Go ahead with your discussion.
Okay, but aren't these the services that you're talking about, they are established right now, correct? They have the clinics there, and they're not part of what they've said that they've had to that they will have to cut if they don't get the $500,000. Is that correct? Those clinics are part of their ongoing budget and they will stay there.
I think I think San Miguel is probably a good example. A very recent addition, a very recent expansion, not one they're contractually obligated to perform or to have gone through. And so if one of the things they wanted to do was pull back from San Miguel, it's unlikely that the county would be in a position of being able to have any effect on that.
Okay.
Because it's not language in the contract that they're going to propose to adjust. Because it was something that they did on their own well after the contract language was developed, as opposed to Cambria.
So when you do look at going back to the table with them and renegotiating, would that be something that you would be, negotiating with them? Is that's an area that obviously has a high need and they have an established clinic? Would that be part of the negotiations to require them to maintain those clinics?
Without giving anything away, in advance of the action that the board would take, which would prompt the negotiation, everything will be on the table. I think they have finally come to the realization that this is likely to happen, and they've started to develop a talking points list of things that they would like to see changed. And as you can imagine, their perspective and ours are going to be, on occasion, not in alignment. Just like any negotiation process would be.
But am I correct in understanding that they cannot close the Cambria clinic without the health department putting their stamp of approval on that?
So
because
it'll have to be the board of supervisors.
Of the board of supervisors.
But I don't have the authority to execute the agreement.
I see.
It'll have to come back to the board of supervisors for execution. It'll be with a staff recommendation, hopefully. We've reached agreement, and we are able to stand before the board in this room and recommend that the board execute the agreement.
I'm thinking about what Mr. Greening said about public health equaling public safety. And part of the arrangement when the hospital closed and the clinics were farmed out was that we had a contract, we had an agreement with CHC to take care of these populations. Now, whether or not, they're beholden to the San Miguel Clinic or the Shandon Mobile Unit or, things that were added after the contract was executed, the agreement was to take care of those populations that were the most vulnerable. And so I wholeheartedly support Commissioner Warren's suggestion that we recommend to the board that $500,000, be taken out of the top 18 and maybe dropped, to a different number. It would not stop you from negotiating with them. You know, perhaps you could come back and, you know, with the figure from talking to CHC, you know, with, you know, 300,000, 100,000 they're willing to lop off. But I think just to keep it on the table and have it recommended as a $500,000 hit isn't fair to those populations that we're supposed to be taking.
On the contract, no, ends when? It's a 5-year contract, right?
That's correct, as it's currently written.
And when is that up?
08-09 is the fifth year.
09, yeah.
Contract includes, even if it hadn't been for the financial, what's happened to the county financially this year, the contract includes language that compels the parties to begin negotiations on a successor or extension agreement. And we're supposed to begin those negotiations prior to the end of the current fiscal year. So we would be talking with them this month and next. We would begin to start talking about what are we going to do about 09-10 and beyond. The county certainly imagined when it entered into this relationship with CHC 4 years ago that it would be a relationship that would last a long time. Wasn't expected that it would be 5 years and end.
So the fourth year ends this July.
June 30th is the end of
June
the fourth
30th,
year,
right. And what would they have gotten under the normal contract next year?
We guess. It's based, you know, there are two contracts, really. One is for clinic services, one is for pharmacy services. Each has a different inflationary index. But we assumed about a $200,000 increase over this year's amount, $5.2 million. And guess, in our status quo budget, we put in for $5.4 million. For the fifth year of the contract.
Is there any further discussion? Does anybody in the public want to make a comment about this motion?
Eric Greening, and I think it's an excellent motion. It probably will not prove be something the Board of Supervisors does, but I think you need to try. I think the case can be made for it, and it's one thing for a department head with the responsibility of a department head in a larger organization to do the things that a department head needs to do. Someone needs to also be voicing from the client's point of view, and it may very well be that if you take that stand, there will also be clients here during the budget hearing. And that will be part of the public education, that if it takes more revenue from somewhere to get out of this tailspin, the only way the public is going to come forward with that revenue is if it hears the need. And it's not going to hear the need from a quiet, harmonious budget hearing that seems to have already been agreed on in advance. It will hear the need if there are some squeaky wheels and some sticky places that have to be talked about. And so I very much congratulate you for the motion you already approved and encourage you to approve this one as well. Thank you.
I have one more question.
Go ahead.
On the math, again, you said 5.4 was what you put in your budget.
Right, for next year.
Yeah, and so 500,000 is off that.
Right.
And so it's 4.9.
Correct.
Okay. So they're getting, they got 5.2 last year, this year, and they're getting
an absolute reduction of 300,000.
Yeah, from this year, right.
My last point will be that this is all bad. So there's nothing, this is all bad stuff. And they try to rank it in worst bad. And we can go through all of these. And who's to say that the public health nurse that's farther down the list that takes care of pregnant or parenting women, we're talking low birth weight infants, premature deliveries, why isn't that important as well? And I think my point is we can have this discussion on every single item here. And I'm going to abstain from this vote again because I think it goes beyond this. Like what Mr. Green said, we need to go beyond what we've got and talk about other funding. because we can cut and pick and move around depending on who the squeakiest wheel is, but there's only one puddle of money, and that's what we have to divide up. And maybe we should try and, if we can make recommendations on bringing more, making that puddle bigger.
I think the one comment, and I agree with what you say, I know that that's coming from a financial background, I know it's a zero-sum game. You take from one, you got to give to another. It's you got to do the math. I think should we go forward with this motion, it would make some more sense to me, or maybe a stronger, I don't know, a stronger statement to, and I've felt with Mr. Greening has stated several times that public health is also a public safety. It's not just health. Health is safety, and it does involve potentially many more lives than police or fire or any of those labeled public safety. So I would just request that that would be part of the motion, however that needs to be incorporated.
Would you like to amend the motion?
Certainly. I'm not a wordsmith, but I think it should say something to the fact that, alluding to the fact that public health is public safety entity.
There's been a proposed amendment to the motion. The maker of the motion needs to agree with this, that the wording that in along with consideration of the support of these budget, not making these budget cuts, that somehow we'll get it in there, that public safety is where we're coming from on that issue. Anybody else want to help me with that? Is the maker agreeable?
Yes, I'm agreeable, and that it's not just about the Cambria Clinic. It's about all of the underserved population in our county that are now being served.
Right. Okay. Any further discussion of the motion now as amended? The second agrees with the amendment. Okay.
Just really quickly, as far as just to kind of further, I too agree that I think that just allowing this to go through without saying something, without having a stance, without advocating for who we're supposed to be advocating for, I just don't think that that sends the right message. I like the fact that it's actually, we are being, I think that we probably aren't going to save these items. I mean, I hope there may be a possibility for maybe saving one, but I think that the important thing is that we need to advocate for the community and for the healthcare in the community, and that I think that's the most important statement that we're saying. And then one other thing is that I do know that the one aspect about the other things on the list that I felt okay with, and I know it's not, I mean, it'd be great to have all of these, but the fact that most of these, I believe they're all vacant positions, correct? So we're living without them already. And so, which I think is a little different in the ombudsman position, and then also losing those doctors in the healthcare at CHC, that's tangible. It's healthcare that's there. It's a person that's there that's going to be taken away.
There seems to be no further discussion. I presume the question is called, and so we will now go to a vote on there. It has been moved and seconded that the Health Commission write a letter, and also follow up by other means available to communicate with the Board of Supervisors that the Health Commission does not believe that the CHC funding should be removed. Now, maybe I don't have that quite right. Is it the $500,000? It should not be reduced from What did you call that, the what you originally? That's it. Let's use that. That the Health Commission recommends to the Board of Supervisors that the status quo budget for the CHC remain status quo. Would that be appropriate wording, Mr. Hamm? Yeah. Okay, good. And that because we consider it an issue of public safety. Okay. All right. So, have we got, do you have the motion, Dean? Well, you don't have to read it, but I just want to make sure you have it. Okay. All right. Good. Then we can now move to a vote. So I think a show of hands. This time I'll forget saying a show of hands, please. All those in favor of the motion, please raise your hands. Those opposed? Abstentions. Okay, the motion is passed with one abstention. Now, does that conclude our business on this agenda item? Nothing further? All right. How about the health agency report from Mr. Hamm?
I was going to say I have no report, but I will at least update you on the status of our discussions with a couple of the top three candidates for the Public Health Administrator County Health Officer position. Interviews were a couple of weeks ago. Several of the candidates traveled great distances, and so we ended up having what were ordinarily considered the final hiring authority interview. There's ordinarily a panel, and then the candidates are ranked, and the top two or three or four or five come back to meet with me in this case. We did that on Saturday so that it would be convenient for folks who had traveled quite a ways. So there were interviews on Friday and Saturday. And we don't have a deal with any of them yet, but we are working on it every day. So two are. Actually, three are. We started out with nine. So, well, no, we haven't ruled anybody out, but we have been talking to the top three.
Okay.
So I don't have anything else unless you have any questions.
Well, thank you very much that report, Mr. Hammond, for all your help this evening with us getting through the budget and last time as well, even though I missed that part. Okay, so we'll have the commission updates. The only thing I have to update you on is that the EVC, which is the Economic Vitality Corporation, for our county has formed a advocacy policy on health care, and their intention is to advocate for higher Medicare and Medicaid reimbursements for health care services provided in San Luis County, and to advocate for the creation and expansion of local health care programs at Cuesta College and Cal Poly to address critical health care personnel shortage, and thirdly, to advocate for the creation and maintenance of a comprehensive countywide program for providing and funding emergency care for uninsured patients. The reason this is of interest to the Economic Vitality Corporation is quite simple. If you want your business community to be able to grow, you have to attract employees. And in order to attract employees, they need to feel like they can get the health care services that they need in that area. That's one real simple premise. They've had a couple of meetings. I attended the first one, the second one that's now being held on the first Wednesday of each month. I was unable to attend the one this month, but hopefully we will have someone from the commission at each of their meetings. And that's all of my report, and I will move on to the other commissioners, and I'll start at my right with Commissioner Warren.
Thank you, Chairman Lance. Yes, I did go to the Drug and Alcohol Advisory Board meeting, and we had a
very interesting report that was put on by Frank Warren. It was a presentation on proposed responsible beverage ordinance, and he went and discussed several different things, and it might be a presentation that it, I don't know if this board would want to have it, but it was pretty interesting, and I just want to give you one example was on the responsible beverage sales and service that, and this has to do with the state ABC, alcohol beverage control and the licensing that they do. And the state, I'll just read what they have here. SLO County has 844 off-sale licenses, which equals one license for 279 people. This far exceeds the ABC statute of licenses allowed per capita, which limits the number of beer and wine licenses that can be issued in a city or county in combination with off-sale general licenses to one for each 1,250 people. This results in higher incidence of DUI and other alcohol-related problems. And I thought that was a pretty astounding figure. So, I don't know. At some point, we might want to entertain having some of that presentation here at the board.
Does that figure include all the tasting rooms throughout?
You know, I don't know. I think it may.
It must.
But that's
throughout the whole county.
Yeah, and he did have a map, but it didn't translate as well that he got from ABC that actually, similar to the one we had on Coxie that showed all the different. So it could be a, and there were several other points, the social host ordinance and working with liability of parents and people that have parties where there's underage kids. So there's a lot of things that they're looking at. And it was a very, very informative discussion. And if anybody's interested, they're also still looking for some board members.
Okay, thank you very much. Commissioner O'Dell?
I have no report.
Commissioner Schmoozer?
Yes, I did attend the April EOC, I'm sorry, EOC on the brain, Adult Services Policy Council meeting. I have several pieces of information and announcements. The first announcement is, which is May is Older Americans Month, and there will be a 24th annual Older Americans Celebration Luncheon Tuesday, May 20th, $9 for seniors, $20 for non-seniors. It is at the Embassy Suites in San Luis Obispo, and there's a flyer. I don't know if we can put it up on the screen or not. Also, I did want to share with the viewing public the EOC Senior Health Screening for May is in several locations. It provides free and low-cost services for seniors that seniors are defined as 50-plus, which is nice to hear, blood pressure, pulse, and weight. Screenings for anemia, diabetes, high cholesterol, and colorectal cancer. Nutritional counseling and referrals are also provided if needed, and it's also provided in Spanish. And the phone number to call for that is 788-0827. Again, that's the EOC Senior Health Screening at 788-0827. Get another flyer. And the last piece of information is the annual Adult Services Policy Council report, the 2708 report, and this year the ASPC focused its attention on three areas: access to health care for low-income adults and seniors with disability, disaster preparedness, which also supported the 211 Health Network, and political advocacy. Are there any questions on any of that? That's a lot of information. And again, I did also want to share with the commissioners that we do have regular attendance by the supervisors, and they are very much involved with what's going on with that council, and particularly the focus of the healthcare issues that council does deal with. It's a very interesting and active meeting. A lot of stuff goes on there.
They have a web page. good link to the Health Commission.
So we have on the screen now the schedule of the screening. Can't quite get it all on there.
Yeah, there it is, yeah, the 1st through the 28th. To answer Commissioner Hetherington's question, Marsha Bollinger is chair of that council, and her, you can email her, yeah. I don't see a website per se, but I will ask. Good question.
Commissioner Hetherington? See, I think next week is the Domestic Violence Task Force. Commissioner Odell has been reviewing pesticide enforcement logs, so he hasn't been doing nothing. You got the pesticide enforcement log, right?
Yeah.
Okay. Okay. So we've been reviewing that information. Mm-hmm. Hopefully we'll get together soon.
Commissioner
Tolbert?
No report.
Commissioner Monsi?
No report.
Okay. That takes care of the commissioner reports. Now for the committee reports. The legislative committee has been in the spotlight here, so I presume you've done, said everything you have to say, but maybe I shouldn't presume that.
You can presume that. There are several pieces of pending legislation that you will be hearing from me ad nauseum, I'm sure. And once the task force or the committee meets again, I will update you. Thanks.
Thank you. Community education, we're working on the website. I think the survey's up there now. You might take a look at it and email myself or Jean any comments that you have. And we're starting to look at links like EOC and other places. So we're moving along. Thanks to Jean. Budget.
No report.
And the nominating committee chairman is not here, but
Mr.
Odell.
We've met today, and we will have for next month's meeting our recommendations for replacing 3 of our members who are resigning as of July 1st, and recommendations for the officers for next year. We will have at our June meeting.
Okay, thank you very much. Now, we have June meeting coming up. Do we have any suggestions for our program for June? Would we have anything on pesticides? Commissioner Odell, possible we could get together before the June meeting and then discuss in June what our findings are? Is that feasible?
I think we would really need more time.
Okay.
You know, what I read.
So I don't think we'll be ready in June. Okay. We're going to have a report on water quality, and senility is setting in. Did we have that report? No, I don't think we did. So maybe water quality is something we might like to see what we can find for June. And I'm sure some other things may surface in the next couple of weeks, so we should. There aren't any other suggestions. Do you have a suggestion, Commissioner Hetherington?
I was thinking it might be nice to have CHC here in June.
Oh, sure.
You know, and
I think they'd be just delighted to be here.
Yeah. Post-budget hearing? Oh, no, it won't be. It'll be before the budget hearing, so that'll be good.
Yeah. Yeah, no, I'm sure they would love to be here. That's a really good idea. Okay, so water and CHC. Commissioner
Grena,
please.
If we speak about water at the next meeting, can we include the discussion of water availability and perhaps, I know in North County we're having, our water table has dropped considerably, and I know there's talk about state water and some issues on storage of state water in current aquifers. I'm not sure who talked about that, but that certainly would cover the area of water quality. So water availability in the county, perhaps, but I think that had something to do with quality.
meaning that from different sources, the quality of the water is different? Is that your point?
State water is not good water.
Okay.
Where our own groundwater used to be good, but we're losing it quickly because of the vineyards.
Okay. Well, I don't know who we might get, but we'll figure something out that would be able to talk on that subject knowledgeably. Did you have a recommendation, Mr.
Greene? Yes, remember the Water Resources Advisory Committee for this county. Our staff liaison is Courtney Howard of the Public Works Department. There is a subcommittee that actually examined the off-stream storage issues with state water. There is also a report that was done in the 1990s by Montgomery Watson called the Sanitary Survey of the State Water Project. Don't read it any time before or after a meal. But they do process the water at Polonio Pass. They actually treat it, they chlorinate it and move it long distances in chlorinated form, which has a whole bunch of other issues. Anyway, your best contact is Courtney Howard, and there may be other resources on the Water Resources Advisory Committee or the staff that works with them.
Okay.
A lot of those issues are being dealt with, but it's timely for you because the water master plan is being updated, and it may or may not be incorporated into the conservation element, which is also being updated, and you may want to weigh in. Thank you.
And of course, we'd like all the contractors to have more water up in the North County so they can sprinkle it. And what kind of water might that be? Okay. Motion to adjourn. This meeting is adjourned. Thank you very much, everybody, for being here and for your patience.